Awesome. Mark LaFerbe told me you were like a techie, and immediately I go, oh, that makes sense, kind of in hindsight, because you love reading or you're always talking about books and you're into the audio and the video, but I just never made that connection till Mark said it. So that's why I started asking about the audio a little bit.
Yeah, I bought my first computer right after seminary, and I was overseas, and I'm also cheap. And then if you, my first computer, I was able to sort of get into the country. Otherwise, a place like the Dominican Republic really nailed you on import duty. They wanted to charge like 100% duty on a computer. And then
Oh,
I
really?
realized that you could bring in parts without any duty. And so then I would just bring in parts into the country and put my own computers together. And so I've often played with this stuff. So,
Yeah, that's another sign of like technical insight, right? You're seeing the system and the loopholes and figuring
yeah.
out the t So, yeah, that's awesome. And that's interesting to talk about the history of how computers have been changing the world. If you've been someone that's been with it, I always took, I had a great computer professor my second year of college, and I just started taking his classes as kind of like a breath of fresh air in my otherwise very like economic and business heavy schedule. And he was great because he was like really into everything from like modern Arduinos to like DOS hacking and the whole range of the history of things.
I took so when I was at when I was at college, I didn't know what I wanted to do. And so I took a lot of math, I took engineering, I took I took a number of computer. Back then it was basic, Fortran, some of those early computer languages, and they had a mainframe on campus and you had to get time. And then PCs were starting to come in when I was in seminary, and they were basically used for word processing, but I didn't have any money for it in school. So finally, when I got my first job, I bought a computer, and then played around with SimCity. That was a kind of a revelation, and little games and stuff, and started building my own. And so, and that's really been handy in this, because I feel bad for John Vervaeke, because he did awaken first. He had his cognitive science and Buddhism class, where the sound was really hard. And you can even look back at Peterson videos and see sort of the development of some of that. But I, right from the start, because I'm just by myself here at the church, it's a small church, I knew that anything I wanted to do, I was going to need to do myself. And so, I played around with YouTube and I built computers. And then when I decided I wanted to do more video stuff, I had to figure out the sound. I had to figure out the video. I had to. And so, actually, if you go way back before the Jordan Peterson days on either the church channel or my own personal channel, you'll find some really raggedy videos where I'm just kind of playing with stuff. Anyway, I had, I didn't have any subscribers. And so I just play with things and throw them up on YouTube and see what happened.
Well, that's the beauty of anonymity and something like our world keeps losing in this like desire to be super famous super quick. And I love
It's a
music
bad
and
desire.
it is though, yeah, because I was gonna say like Aerosmith was like bad for 10 years and then just dominated for a decade or 2 decades or, and then punk rock, like Bad Religion, no one's heard about them outside of a small group. And then they're like the, biggest flagship band after that. Because it's better to fail privately. It's much softer when your critics are like your family and your friends or a group that barely knows you. And there's something about staying small that like people just resist so strongly.
Well,
Right
I
now,
was
so
so I was playing around with YouTube, and again, you'll find some videos before the Jordan Peterson thing. And then of course Freddie came along and said, "Pastor Paul, me and you should do a TV show." And I'm thinking, I'm not going down to public access. And so I said, we'll just do the Freddie and Paul show. And we had, two or three people that would watch it semi-regularly. And that was me and Freddie and his mom and my mom and sister every now and then. And so we just played with it. And then, of course, when the channel got a lot larger because of the Jordan Peterson stuff, I'm like, oh boy, what do I do with this? And I, when it hit 2000, I was really unnerved, because I did not want, I did not want all that disruption. And I basically had to reconcile at some point that, okay, there's going to be more people. I'm going to have to deal with more people. The emails keep coming. This is part of my ministry that I'm going to have to deal with. But people early on were like, oh, I can't wait till this gets to 1 million subs. And it's like, I hope it never gets to 1 million subs, because just look at Jordan Peterson and his life. And okay, he's wealthy. Okay, he's got clout. Okay, he's got all of that. But he can no longer be a clinical psychologist. He can no longer be a classroom lecturer. I mean, those things that I think were really fruitful and life-giving for him, and I think for the world, were basically simply destroyed by his fame. His fame brings him some other things, but is it really worth it? I don't know.
No, the comedians, I love comedy, and comedians talk about this. You want to be big enough to attract people that care about you, to have that really cool community, but not so big that you're the headline of Twitter and getting, you know, people that don't appreciate you hear about you and have opinions of you. And yeah, I love watching you, and you find this sweet spot and are able, like, you have some of the most vibrant comment sections out of anyone in this corner of the internet. And it's really impressive, because it's not just people monologuing, and it's not just nothing. There's actual conversations happening. And that's hard to do, because most people are coming in as intellectuals or system thinkers, and they don't have, I think, that skillfulness that you have in kind of popularizing things and keeping things translated to that level that allows everyone to kind of participate in. It's really, I appreciate it quite a bit when I read your comments.
It's I think that too is a function of size, in that I appreciate comments that disagree with me, because how else will I learn? There are trolling comments, fanboy comments. Okay, it's flattering. That's fine. People just expressing their appreciation, very welcome, because then it helps me know that, okay, I'm helping people. I'm being helpful for their lives. That's super valuable to me. People who are just in there to be a troll or be a jerk, that's a waste of time. I usually just ignore those comments. But, you know, even critical comments that are well thought through, and there are many of them in the comment section, and I do read them, and I gain a lot from them. I might not change my mind, I might not agree with them, but I'll usually learn from them. And over time, that kind of dialogue is really what conversation is for. And no, you're right. I'm tremendously grateful for those who take the time to write a decent comment. It's a very worthwhile thing.
Yeah, and it perpetuates that, right? When you embrace that and encourage that and kind of reward it by interacting with it, that's really cool. And yeah, what is the, I mean, part of, I think Jonathan Peugeot says this really well, like, part of being part of the church body is being around people that you disagree with. And there's actually a huge benefit in that. And I've tried to appreciate that in the world, and it's helped me grow, I think. And so how does someone become skillful at that? Because it seems like our culture is like sameness and self-isolating.
Yeah.
And that I used to love, like in like the old timey days, they'd say like, I agree to disagree. And we've almost lost that. Yeah.
It's practice. It's not leaving. People insufficiently appreciate the art of not leaving. Of not leaving a relationship, of not leaving a church. This is, you know, some of the monastic orders have the discipline of basically of staying. And there's a tremendous amount you can learn from that. Now, the reason we don't do it is because it feels like a waste of time. It's annoying. We like what we want, and we want to get what we want. And so we pursue it. And so we leave and we go on to something else. And what that does is make us a prisoner of our desires and our whims and our wills. And this is, tomorrow I'm going to put out the first of a what will hopefully be a significant series on the marriage crisis, and it's conversations with Rod Hare and Eamon and Catherine Wilson, and so much of the wisdom of marriage is not leaving. I learned this when I was before I was married. My pastor in Grand Rapids, Dave Bieland, who's been on the channel, he was recommending Walter Wangerin's book on marriage, and it's a very basic book. It basically said, don't leave and learn to forgive. If you can do those two things, you can stay married. And it's, if you can do those two things, you can actually grow in marriage, even if your marriage is sometimes not fun or not comfortable. And part of where we're at in an affluent, powerful society is that people have the option to leave, and so they do. And there's a price for that. And it's the same goes for church, goes for friendships. You know, I get a lot of pushback sometimes with, you know, why do I continue to not only hang out, but sometimes on my channel give visibility to individuals in this little corner who have very critical things to say about Christianity, critical things to say about my particular tradition within Christianity, critical things to say about me. If I leave the relationship, I continue to feed my ego, continue to feed my convenience, my expediency. And if I stay and listen to stuff that's not fun to listen to or uncomfortable, or even stuff that I disagree with and think is wrong, I learn to stay. And that's really important.
Yeah, it reminded me of my mother, who, when she got married, thought she'd immediately know how to cook. And she thought it would be this easy, awesome thing. It's like, oh no, I did the hard part. That was the marriage. And now all the rest of it will be automatic. And then maturing and learning to put in the hard work. Her husband, my father, became blind from type 1 diabetes, and going like, I have to stick with this. I could leave at any moment. And just that kind of attitude, I savor it. And it's really different than, like you said, oh, this isn't placating to my desires, time for a divorce or time to check out. And it is hard to care about someone that upsets you deeply or that puts you in a really uncomfortable position. And so that's excellent. And is there anything else you want to add to that? Or
well, part I just of, say that as the whole skill is. Yeah. No, but part of as a culture, we have, I think in past generations, we have valued and publicly supported the value of staying. And what we've lost in the value of me first, which is what we've done as a culture, we have lost a lot. People have lost the capacity to love, because I think you said it very well, and your mother learned it very quickly. Oh, I'm married. Well, okay. Well, now what you learn in marriage is how to love, and how to love is not a fun thing to learn. Children teach you this. Pets teach you this. Communities teach you this. Churches teach you this. Many of the things that many of the most worthwhile things we can learn are things we don't want to learn. You know, one of Jordan Peterson's great rules is do what is meaningful, not what's expedient. That meaningful is sort of a nice way of saying what's hard. And and one of the things that I learned too, as pastoring a church with a lot of older people, is your life gets harder as you go. Your body starts giving you more and more trouble when you're young. You can do anything. You can eat anything. If you're lucky, you can, you know, you might not gain a lot of weight as you get older. Now, suddenly, well, I have to watch what I eat. I have to intentionally exercise. I have to regularly go to the doctor. I have to do all of these things, which are really an inconvenience, and I don't want to be bothered. Okay. Well, if you don't do those things, you wind up in your 70s or 80s with usually significant health problems that modern medicine will help you to survive, but you're going to suffer from them. And so the truth is, growing old is it can be deeply meaningful, and there are many things that come with age, but it is also a journey in loss and a journey in the old Christian practice of mortification, which is dying to yourself. And again, if you work life in that way, you can grow in wisdom. But again, our culture values generally such trivial things that something like wisdom isn't valued, it isn't passed on, then people suffer from it.
Yeah, that's so important. I live in Florida, the land of the elderly. And I like it because it reminds me of my future. And I don't try to dwell too much in like, oh, I'm 70 already. But it's really good because you see, like you said, when you're young, I remember my first job, I worked at a fast food place. And I had access to these little cups, and I could drink as much milkshakes and sodas in these little cups as I wanted. And I would just drink them all day. And, you know, I go get all my calories from like Hi-C orange and Coca-Cola and strawberry milkshake. And then, like you said, if you do that, you don't see obese 80-year-olds. You don't see smoking 80-year-olds. You don't, like, you see someone, you know, kind of hunched over like this, and I do, and I go, oh, pull your posture up. Like, gravity is happening. Even if your healthy body doesn't notice it, I can notice it consciously and remind myself through observing others. And the psychology literature, because I have a master's, like kind of an all but dissertation PhD in applied psychology. And the literature is like, there's a difference between well-being and meaningfulness. And John and Jordan both make that point that what feels good, having your body not hurt, like those are well-being things, and having a stable income. But like, people will sacrifice that when they see the like life in their children's eyes for the first time, or when they commit themselves to these projects like you and John do that are not financially rewarding and socially maybe trying at times. But wow, it must be just something marvelous once in a while to reflect back and say, there's a community growing, like Estuary is happening. I hear you talk about from time to time, and John participating in these things, really the Thunder Bay conference, right? Like, what was like the realization of actually just seeing that for you, just to tie it into that?
It was, you know, we're doing all this talking on screens, which is a wonderful thing that we're able to do. It's better than talking on the phone. We're able to share it via YouTube, which is a wonderful thing, and people are clearly benefiting from it. But there is something very different about being in a room together. And it's, you know, it's scale, you know, again, part of what we're bumping into and already started talking about, scale is difficult. And so I was glad Thunder Bay wasn't too big. And one of the events I did very early on was, my sister has a sort of an Airbnb in Connecticut, and I just basically said, if anybody wants to come to this, you know, here's a sign up. And I had no idea what we would do, but you know, there's rooms you can stay in at my sister's, there's hotels around, et cetera, et cetera. And we basically had a dozen of us, and we spent 2 days just in my sister's space talking. That's all we did. We just talked. We got to know each other. We got to share stories. We got to share what we've been thinking. And that was a deeply meaningful, helpful thing. And I made some friends from that experience. And Thunder Bay was a little bit bigger. We got to do paintball. We got to do some stuff on stage. But I think, as I saw in Thunder Bay and as I saw in German Festival, which was earlier and was really modeled after the Thunder Bay template, was the real benefit was people getting to meet each other, friendships getting made. I noticed that in the Chicago event that I did earlier in the summer, I was talking to one person, and he was like, well, you know, I heard it was going on. I thought about going to it. He was thinking more in terms of the stage stuff, but then you can see Paul on stage, you can see Paul on YouTube. That's kind of the same. But then I heard that Chad was going, and I wanted to meet Chad. And so when I hear those things, it's that knitting together of community. It's that, it's those burgeoning relationships and those growing friendships. That's where the value is, because as you very quickly figure out on YouTube, you can listen to Peterson, you can listen to Verveke, you can listen to Vanderclay, you can listen to Peugeot, and all that one-way stuff. I mean, as long as we're giving you stuff that you find meaningful or helpful, fine, no problem. But it's the relationships with one another that there's real possibility for lifelong growth. And again, back to where we started, if you stay in the friendship, if you stay in the relationship, and relationships come and go, friendships come and go. This is kind of a natural part of the flow of life. But hopefully there are a handful of relationships that go for major periods of your life, maybe even your whole life. I was watching, my wife and I were watching the next season of The Crown came on, and we were watching the episode where, you know, because the queen asked her younger sister to not pick up a relationship with a divorced man for the sake of the crown. And that was 40 years ago. And her sister continued to sort of hold that against her. And so they were doing a lot of processing of that. But at the end of the episode, the queen and her sister were on the phone and they were talking and they were sharing the fact that, yes, there's major things between them, but they are still sisters and they still love each other. And their sisterhood is also a friendship that transcends the things between them and the sins between them and the betrayals between them even. And that kind of thing is so valuable. It's such a gift that when it's lost, a big part of life is lost. So the Thunder Bay event, the German event, the Chicago events, these kinds of events, yeah, they're fun to hear Verveke and Vanderclay maybe take a selfie and maybe get some questions answered. But the real key is, who are you meeting there? What friendships are you starting or strengthening? And what kinds of, how are you working on your fabric of relationships and strengthening that? Because those are the things that really count.
Yeah, I'm lucky that I did a lot of nerdy, like Dungeons and Dragons, Magic the Gathering stuff. And my mom was gracious enough to let me go to these conventions 800 miles away, 300 miles away. And the bonding, the human bonding that happens when you participate in these things, and the strangers you meet, and you go, oh, we're like each other. Oh, let's exchange phone numbers. Or, oh my gosh, there's someone else in my city. I didn't know there'd be two people from Chicago here. And now when I go back and you go back, we can start hanging out. And the information part of the internet is awesome. And it's great to be able to consume or connect with, is probably a much healthier word than consume, ideas like John's or Jordan Peterson's or whoever's, compared to like the top three channels or the top 50 channels that we used to kind of have to do. And the embodiment of being there, I told my friend who I had met for the first time there, she lived in Amsterdam. And so she flew there and we got to meet. We'd been only hanging on Zoom. And I told her, I'm like, my whole body is vibrating from all of just the first person physical joy that happened there. And it's so undervalued, even just hugging and sitting near people during the church service. I loved hearing people singing while I was singing. There was something very different than singing in my car to a pop star who's clearly a better singer, but that group thing,
that's right,
in body is really strong. And those, yeah, I think I remember more of my lunches and small talk in the hallway than I do like those killer insights and wow moments from the speak from you and the other speakers. So I'm glad you brought that up. And bringing it back into the body is, I hope, one of the next steps in this whole corner of the internet, because it's great to have Zoom friends, and I love people in like over a dozen countries now that I spend a lot of time with online, but it's different to just sit across from someone and be eye to eye, or sit next to someone. And I resonate a lot with what you said. That was very salient and important for me as well.
Well, it's part of why I do talk about estuary, and I do encourage people. Now I think partly because of the way promotion happens in our culture, when I talk about estuary, people assume that I am trying to do something like sell a product, like sell a product with the pretense of eternity or divinity, such as, when you call the iPhone the God phone. I mean, the iPhone is supposed to change your life. The iPhone is supposed to make everything magical. Estuary is not going to change your life. Estuary is not going to make anything magical. Estuary is simply one of many opportunities to lean into your life, to try to bring that in-personness and make something happen. Now, again, I always talk about estuary as alongside church. I don't see it as displacing church. I see it as assisting people and perhaps a potential connection to church. But when you talk about what you experienced at Thunder Bay, well, that's what people have been doing, in churches, in pubs, in coffee houses, on school boards, in town halls, and I mean, this people have had to work together for all of human history or not survive. And that press of working together has forced them to pursue the discipline of staying, to and then all of that necessity has then borne other good fruit. And again, part of, okay, well, now, well, maybe I don't have to see another human being. I don't have to go into the office to work. I can work from home. Okay, I'm just going to Zoom people. And it's really comfortable to wake up, to get out of bed and, put on a shirt, work in my pajama bottoms as if I have a Zoom call, and, have my coffee, have the particular kind of coffee I like, and to have enough money and to have enough leisure and to have enough this to be totally isolated. And then suddenly, well, why do I feel so lonely? And so, it's like so many of these things are like junk food. So social media is like junk food. It's like, I feel hungry. Oh, a bag of chips. Eat a bag of chips. Oh, some candy. Eat some candy. And then you've got all that fat, all that sugar. An hour from now, I feel hungry again. More fat, more sugar, more milkshakes, more sodas. And you get in a cycle, whereas so much of what we really need are, well, maybe you should go visit your mom. Yeah, but my mom always says this when I get there, and it makes me feel uncomfortable. Yeah, I know. Probably you should listen to her a little bit. She might not be wholly right, but you should probably go visit your mom. You should probably have a friend. You should probably go to church. Well, if I go to church, we're going to sing songs that I don't like. Yep. The sermon might not be any good. Yep. Some of the people there are annoying. Yep. All of those things are true. But when you go to the gym, you do things that you don't normally want to do. If you and going to church isn't that different. So,
Yeah, you're right. It's I was lucky that there was a really, really shy woman in grad school that people thought she hated everyone. She was so quiet and no one knew what she was thinking. And I liked her. So like when everyone would leave class, she would leave last and I would just talk to her for half an hour, or we would talk. And one time she said to me, because I told her I was the only child, she said, "Oh, that's really sad. Your mom has no one around." And her telling me that, I go, oh yeah, you know, I'm 1,000 miles, because I don't know if it's because I'm a guy or because I'm thoughtless or both or whatever, but I just wasn't kind of thinking in that frame. And that's how people used to think. And there's a really good book that's slipping my name, that when I was volunteering with these children who had been homeless and just horrible, horrible lives, and I kept kind of saying what you said, like, oh, you know, can't we just feed them some junk food and teach them and they'll be easy? And they go, no. When you have no money, your relationships bail you out. When you're middle class, upper class, you know, and I've been in the most wealthy, affluent neighborhoods because I tutor in the county, and I know people that knew George Steinbrenner and that the penthouse of the tallest building here. And they're just as annoyed by their private neighbors as we are by our apartment complex neighbors. You keep building the fences, and then there's like a psychopath with $50 million in your neighborhood instead of one with no money. That's the big difference. And, you
Which is
know,
a lot
just,
more dangerous of a
oh
psychopath.
yeah. Yeah. The drama that sometimes I would see paled, or at least was qualitatively different. Yeah. So it's we forget, once we have a certain amount of material success, how important relationships are. And we're all dependent as children and babies, and we're born in need for these relationships where we don't question their value. And then once we become like adults, we forget, and kind of going back to that level and going, no, one day my car is going to be broken down. If I'm angry and contemptuous to the police all the time, what about that one time they helped me? Or, so I 100% find a lot of value in that way of thinking. And it's like, I don't know, John's, you know, Eric Fromm said this, and I loved Eric Fromm before I knew John, but like the having and being mode, stuff is so much less meaningful than a 5-year relationship or a eye contact and holding hands and hugs and those things. Like, you can have all the tech in the world and the nicest house with the best view, but like you said, if you're alone, what a waste of a life if that's the majority of it. So I really appreciate how you're saying what you're saying. And yeah, just being confronted with strangers does that so well, because once you can look past that and go, okay, what is our common ground here, or how can I value you beyond like these annoying things, and you're actually becoming more agopic. And also, like, I don't know what the, yeah, you just like, you're reciprocated when you're a more benevolent person that you don't even realize in the what other people are seeing in you when you start to make that kind of turn. And it's free, right? Like, going to church costs you maybe a small tithe. You throw in $5 for the donuts and coffee or whatever. And it is very antithetical to a lot of the modern kind of values, but so wholesome once you start participating in it.
Well, it's ironic that, on YouTube there is an entire, so when Jordan Peterson's 12 Rules for Life came out, it came out in the as a self-help book. Oh, okay. And in some ways, this little corner is part of the larger wisdom industry on YouTube. There are many far larger than this little corner. There are many other video channels that are, trying to talk about wisdom and self-improvement and all of this. And a lot of that content is about it's ironically laced with narcissism, because the motivation for self-improvement is a consumer motivation. And the irony is that itself is going to continue to perpetuate the loneliness and the isolation and the narcissism, when the kinds of people that we love, again, ironically, are the people that can listen to us, the people that will listen to our crappy little stories, the people that will hear us vent, the people that will pay attention and care when we're suffering from maybe the consequences of our own self-indulgence or incompetence. you know, it, again, it's in some ways your mother, it's your family, it's your church, it's your it's people that have learned to love. And the irony is that if you've learned to love, you will never be without people, because the world is hungry for people with the knowledge and capacity to love, and they have no interest in people who are narcissistic, self-involved, and basically an empty hole that is continuing to just simply suck in. The difficulty, of course, is loving is costly. And if you are going to love, it is going to cost you, and you're going to need a source that you can spend from that is beyond yourself. And again, that is what religion is about. As a Christian, I look to Jesus to give me strength to love people even when I am empty and sick of trying. And you have that in the most common relationships of your life. And we look at it as a defect, but it is actually built into us that we can perhaps step away from the whirlpool that is hell. Because that's hell is.
Is what is hell now?
Well, that is what hell is. C.S. Lewis in his
The
book,
emptiness of the narcissist, or I just it,
it's the self-sucking pinpoint. Of the narcissist. The narcissist continues, says, feed me, feed me. And C.S. Lewis wrote the book, The Great Divorce. And the book begins in a gray city where you can have everything that you want. And what you very soon realize is the city is full of magnificent homes that are empty because, as you said about the nice neighborhood, people keep making bigger and better homes further and further away from each other because the one thing they can't actually have is community. Because the one thing community requires is sacrificial generosity. And if all I am is a giant sucking sound of people who are here to feed me and indulge me and give to me, well, if you have a whole group of people like that, I watch that sometimes. I see people have the idea, oh, look at all these lonely people. If we put all these lonely people together, then they won't be lonely. And it's like, no, you have no idea.
You have a crowd of lonely people.
Exactly. The antidote to two lonely people is not that they will see each other. It is that one of those persons needs at least a little bit of capacity to donate something in themselves to the other. And then for the other to reciprocate and to begin getting that, you know, begin getting that going where actually they are both giving to each other. And then you begin to get a dynamic. And so I've seen churches before that are filled with incredibly needy people, and nobody in that church has the capacity to give and feed others. Mm. And the churches just fail. They just implode because you're going to need needy people, but you're also going to need people that can give to the needy people. And that gets tremendously complex because sometimes you have sort of a codependency where you have people who need to be needed, but that isn't quite right either, because then you just have this little cycle of codependency that goes down. That doesn't work either. And so, in other words, there needs to be a fount of never-ending generosity.
I love this.
And that is basically God that gives and does not need to receive. That is so brimming with being and life that it gives to others. And so then the path to godliness is becoming like that fount of generosity to the rest of a needy world. But again, if done in the wrong way, it can become codependency, which again cycles down into that abyss of hell. But if it in fact, I mean, C.S. Lewis writes about this in the Screwtape Letters, and where the demons, you know, Screwtape, Wormwood, Screwtape is writing to Wormwood and says, you know, we, the demons, are hungry and wish to devour. He, the other side, is giving and wishes to, you know, wishes to give his agency and generosity so that they also might give. And now, if we are going to learn that, we do need people that need to receive, as we all do.
Yeah.
But we also need to pick up our cross.
Yeah.
Take that up and to give to the point of emptiness so that, and then to see him filling us again so that we can get this dynamic going. And that is reciprocal broadening.
Because you have to make sure you're taking care of yourself and get rid of all these hang-ups first. That was, to me, I heard, I don't know how much if you ever listened to Jordan Hall, but on some podcast like 4.5 years ago, I love cognitive science and learning, and he talks about awesome ideas. And he said, like, well, step one to participate in these kind of communities is you got to get yourself up to that level first. And I think I took that seriously, and I do. I was thinking a lot about circling, and you learn skills of not only how to listen, but how to care and have boundaries. But then once you can do that, then, like you said, you can actually make space for others. And we think of ourselves, I have one body, so I'm one thing, but like so much of us is our relationships. And when someone dies, a part of us dies. And, you know, getting that capacity for me to be healthy enough to not collapse into your pain, or to just be bleeding out this narcissistic pain, is transformative. And then once you can start to be in community, that's this like whole other love, this agapic, phileic, eros, all the loves of the Greek language show up, and you go, oh, the universe is really good. Why was I so full of contempt and loneliness when actually I keep reflecting and life is like 90% good? Of course, there's always gonna be problems, and cars will break down and economies will inflate and wars will happen. But when your self and your smaller world are mostly or almost completely loving, it's like, it's amazing. It's like heaven on earth. I mean, in a sense. And it's like you said, I love Tom Cheatham. I don't know if you know him at all. He was mentioned in John's series. They've done an interview. He studied Henry Corbin. He's a Henry Corbin scholar who has like 5 books on him. And he says, you have to get yourself ready for God. That's like a Corbin he's quoting. And I was like, that's so right. Because if I put in my practice, if I focus effortfully on relationships, then like my whole world changes. If I think, why isn't the world just loving me all the time? Then I might get that love, right? Like it's really tricky because there's a lot of randomness in life and our thoughts aren't always on the truth. But there'll be like some confusion from time to time when I go like, wait, I thought love was just going to come to me naturally and it's not. Whereas like what you're saying, if you really make this like a long-term, it depends who you are, but like a 2 to 5 year plan to become a person who lives in a meaningful life and start to do those things and learn these skills. I loved Jonathan Peugeot's kind of Neoplatonic when he said, like, when the small pieces are being loved by the big piece and they're sending love up to the big piece, there's this kind of Platonic ideal happening. And, you know, you could put it in the Christian framework or the Greco philosophical framework, or there's a million, you know, instances of this pattern, but it's like, it's a really smart pattern. Cause I mean, that's like at the smallest level, the family does that, right? Like if the family is loving the kids and the kids are being obedient and generative within the family structure, you look and you go, oh, this is kind of awesome. I'm really happy to be part of this. And if you go, why isn't this person like this? And why aren't they doing that? And you just have this kind of different orientation, then no kidding, it's a horrible family to participate in. So yeah, I think that's excellent to hear. Yeah, I love you're a pretty good talker for a preacher.
Yeah, well, that's what preachers do. We're talkers, and we like to talk. It's a besetting sin of preachers. They like to hear their own voice.
No, I meant it in a compliment. I think one of
I
the
know
things
you did.
That most impressed me about both you and John, kind of being in, how do I say this? I take this the right way, like being in your kind of later part of life and being past that like career seeking thing, is that you have the safety to not worry about your reputation when you talk. And you can say, like, I'm already established, so I can kind of say things that might be a little controversial, which I appreciate quite a bit, because it's hard for sometimes people that are younger to say these things, because they have to toe the line and such.
Yeah, and that's a function of community. You know, it's there's something ironic has developed in our society where I think 50 years ago people thought that churches were more restrictive than the rest of society, and I think what we're discovering now is that there's a great deal of freedom in churches that there isn't in the rest of society. And it is true that both John and I are at a point in our career where, for a variety of reasons, I knew that, well, there's almost all careers have a sort of a ladder. And in the preacher world, at least in a denominational world, the original ladder was sort of becoming a denominational bureaucrat, which was never terribly appealing to me, because the irony there is that you spend all these years preaching and teaching and doing discipleship, and then you wind up doing administration, which is the least favorite part of my job. I really have to discipline myself to do the little bits of administration I need to do. The other path that has sort of opened up in the evangelical world is to try to grow your church to be a mega church pastor and be a superstar and be on TV or radio or Christianity Day or yada, yada, yada. That wasn't going to happen. The denominational bureaucrat thing wasn't going to happen. There was no real ladder to climb for me in the denomination. And so that's led to, I can get on the internet and actually tell people what I really think. And there are, I have to mind my P's and Q's in certain areas because I am in a confessional denomination. Yet at the same time, there are churches sometimes that, because the churches are looking for pastors, and in COVID, I think a lot of pastors dropped out of the ministry because it was hard. And so I'll get these letters from churches sometime. And I just got one last week, and it's a perfectly lovely church in a different area of the country, and wanted to know if I would be interested in participating in their pastoral search process and yada, yada, yada. And I usually, because they don't know who I am, they don't know I have a YouTube channel, they don't know any of the things I do. And so then I'll basically say, I really don't think this is going to happen, but I don't like giving you a hard no. So here's the link to my YouTube channel. I spent a considerable amount of time doing this. I don't intend to give this up. Just take a look at it and let me know if you can imagine you would actually want your senior pastor spending this much time involved in something like this. And invariably I get the letter back. Well, thank you for returning our correspondence, but God bless you on your ministry, which is basically, this is not what we want our pastor doing. So in that sense, you're exactly right that John and I are both at a point in our careers where we're a certain number of years from retirement. We both have jobs that we can do this and our day job. And it fits in well with what we're trying to do. So it does give a tremendous amount of freedom. Whereas if, in fact, I were 20 years younger, I would be facing, college bills in the future for my kids instead of having them in the past. Having to consider reputation and a bunch of other things. Well, I remember a couple of years ago, one of my sons, he was playing around with some things, and he works more in the political realm. And he said, Oh, you've done a YouTube channel and you've gotten a lot of visibility and a certain amount of clout from that. And I said, I don't recommend that too much to people in their younger years because probably number one, you won't get off zero, because that's unusual. Number two, if you do, and if you actually are successful in the way that you imagine success should be, that's a very daunting path because you will and probably sort of put yourself in a little corner and you will reputationally hamstring yourself that is going to limit your potential in other endeavors and areas of life. One should not really desire success, that kind of success at a young age. I think in many ways, a better path in life is Scott Adams wrote about this in his book on success, which I thought was really an excellent book. Take your 20s and 30s, especially to gain a lot of skills, learn some wisdom, gain a breadth of skills and experience. And then when you get into your 40s and 50s and 60s, then you can begin to leverage those things and at that point do something bigger. Again, I think our society is a little upside down in that we, in this screen world, we tend to prioritize the young and the beautiful, like a soap opera. And
Like the French before the French Revolution and certain tipping points in Roman culture, obsessed with youth, is a weird place culturally, generally to be. And yeah, we see this in South Korea. Young people get more like plastic surgery than ever in history. Both men and women are buying more makeup at like alarming rates. And yeah, the part of like the meaning crisis. I work on this project that John talks about sometimes, with this wisdom stuff, and they talk about elderhood. And again, in Florida, oh, I mean, I've talked to neighbors, and they'll share insights about World War II and the Korean War. And one neighbor told me recently, like, I was like, oh, I'm gonna get a Tesla. It's gonna be super sweet, and I love driving, and it's gonna drive itself. He's like, I don't think they've worked that out. I'd be a little skeptical. And I got a more affordable, reasonable car. It totally got me to Thunder Bay with what it did. And I'm really glad in hindsight that someone, 35 years older than me just cared enough to share their thoughts in a way that like penetrated my consciousness and my intellect, and it helped. And yeah, it's very powerful, the humility that you learn by living 60, 70, 80 years. And we just treat those people like, oh, get them in the cheapest nursing home, talk to them as little as possible. And it sucks for everybody, because at the end, like, I'm going to be that age one time. And if that's what people are going to treat me as, that stinks. So it's not even good from a very self-centered point of view. And it's really sad that those people, part of what, if you think about evolution, what separates us from other species is we have grandparents and squirrels don't. And having four sets of people with four sets of perspective versus kind of one to zero in most other species, not even two really, that's profound. And the amount of human love and wisdom that can be incorporated, whether it's a crossing guard role or a volunteering or just appreciating your grandparents more often. And again, church brings that all in, right? Because it's all ages, not just like the self-selecting that happens in the market or wherever else you are in society. So yeah, I think there's a lot of really cool things in what you said there.
Ideally, church does that. Part of what's happened in churches is that consumerism has impacted the church. You see age and demographic segmenting in church. Part of what's done this is our economy, where I live on the other side of the continent from my mother and my sister. That it's difficult because I've got my kids here now and I've got my mother and my sister and some of the family over there. Ideally, we would all be in the same place. Ideally, there would be a church at the center of the village. In many ways, we're sort of built for that life. And that life was an amazing life on many respects. but also challenging. I remember when my mother moved back to the town that she was born and raised in from having lived in Patterson, you know, the big city where she and my father did most of their ministry. One thing she said to me, she said, I was a little unprepared for just how small the town was and what that would mean. So she, you know, she continued to appreciate the cosmopolitan New York, New Jersey metroplex and all of what that offered her for years.
Yeah.
At the same time, now, you know, appreciating she's got nieces and nephews around and, you know, until the death of, you know, her sisters, she had sisters and brothers-in-law around and, you know, she lived in that village and she continues to attend the church that she was baptized in as a baby.
Wow.
And, you know, for many of us living at a certain socioeconomic level in the country, we just look at that and it's like, ooh, that's... You know, my job very quickly made me move all around.
Operate. That's right. College does that. People leave to go to good colleges. And then business does that. They leave to bigger cities. And it's just bifurcated and split the whole thing. And you said, I've heard you said today, even like you're from Michigan. All my family's from Michigan. And all of their relatives lived in these small towns. And they lived within the state. And they lived within driving distance. And now... my mom is number two of seven and they all live in different cities and they're all spread out. And then their kids are even more spread out.
Yeah.
And it's, there's something really powerful about going, oh, I'm sick. Can you bring me soup? Or, oh, you surprised me. Or even weddings become hard to achieve and things like that.
Yeah.
It's we have all of this political, economic, logistical power, but all of these changes have, we've forgotten like the family in the center. And you can't replace a relationship with a great grandparent or a sister or all the, remember when Facebook first came out and everyone had like 1,000 friends and little, everyone's human brain's like 1,000 friends. What does that mean? You know, the reasonable people were saying, and it's like, no, that's not 1,000 friends. That's a weird icon that you're reifying and being hypnotized by, but actually, you know, one deep friend that you might get annoyed by sometimes, but that you suffer together with and celebrate together with is way more meaningful than this kind of modern give me what I want thing. And not to throw the baby with the bathwater out, because it's awesome that we can, like you said, communicate with Zoom. And modern medicine allows people to extend their lifespans and remove things that would otherwise cause them in that ancient world with that beautiful church in the center in the small village to just die. Like the average lifespan in Rome was like 32 and half of all women suffered or died in their first childbirth. So it's like, I'm glad to leave that world, but we don't want to just leave the relational aspect of our humanity for these material benefits, which seems so attractive, right?
Yeah. I, you know, so when John talks about the meaning crisis, I look at the meaning crisis has been with us for a long time. Two people who wrestled with it were Tolkien and Lewis. And part of what Tolkien and Lewis came down to was friendship.
It's the best virtue. It's in Plato. I think about it a lot and it's so powerful because like, just again, at like an animal level, all insects, if they have the opportunity to go towards their species or alone, they go together and bats hang upside down at night together. Plato, his academy, it was all about friendliness. It's everywhere. Friendship is like almost a meta virtue to me that if you pour yourself into it in a smart way. You can't just, you know, throw yourself into relationships where people don't care back or where you don't have common ground. But if you do it smartly, it is like just a life-changing thing that in this world is so transformative. Yeah.
And again, it's something that is done. It's, you know, part of the weakness of what we've been doing for the last few years. It is the weakness is basically the virtue of what you can do via Zoom. But what you can't do via Zoom, again, back to the Thunder Bay part of this conversation, is be there together. And it's you can strengthen a friendship via Zoom. You can maybe initiate a friendship via Zoom, but the friendship pursues a goal that Zoom can't host. And so we can talk about friendship, but we're pointing to it and not embodying it often, and that's the challenge.
Yeah. I mean, the meeting people in person is powerful, and not trivializing that. Like, I have a buddy that we just go out and get a pizza every couple of weeks, and it's like one of the most important things in my life. And you can't fake that. And we don't talk about building businesses or these great ideas or anything like that. And it's really just such a simple thing to care and be cared for in an embodied way. I mean, kind of non-industrial cultures, their children are being held or within eyesight something like 98% of their lives up to 7. Our children are handed off to nannies, dropped off to daycare, screens. I love when I'm driving, you see like the minivan with the screens just blaring in front of you. And I had a Game Boy when I was a kid. I loved that thing. So I get kind of the allure, but it's like a simulated reality. It's at best like powdered eggs to real eggs. And
So Robert, how did you find this little corner of the internet? How did this thing start for you?
Yeah, so I loved those grainy John Vervaeke lectures before his series, and I studied cognitive science. I've worked in multiple NASA labs. I've studied creativity, meditation, teams and training. When I was 12, I would go to the library and just read that little social science section that was next to the religious section and read about Buddhism and Stoicism. And I've read the Bible like 5 times, and my mom is a huge Christian. I've been baptized. So that's the long-winded way of saying I love this stuff. And I was studying in Michigan State in Lansing, where you know. And so that's not far from John. And I was studying there and studying things that he was related to. So I just emailed him and we met. And he's the nicest person in person.
He really is.
And yeah, and he just has showered me with his love and kindness. And we have so much in common that we've been talking since I met him.
When did you meet him? Did you meet him before a lot of the YouTube stuff took off?
Right, before even, I think, the first episode of The Meaning Crisis. So it was, he had those lectures online. He had that talk with Jordan Peterson at the cast. And so I just was like, oh, this, I would cite his ideas in my class papers. This is a top-ranked program, and I'd say combinatorial explosion and different things. And the teachers would always respond, like, more of this. Why didn't you write more about that? And so, yes, that's how I got to know him. And it's like if there's, you know, 10 places you go to hunt, and then you find one place that's as abundant as all 10, John's just an amazing thinker, and he's so humble, and he's into, like, I always avoided philosophy because it wasn't practical, and I studied economics. I avoided positive psychology and studied applied psychology because it wasn't practical. But maybe philosopher is going to be the last job necessary in the economy, because it's like we need wisdom, we need care. And so, yeah, so I love John. I mean, I did his meditation series when he did it on COVID, like 95% of the days, where that's where I met Mark. And people like that. And I done all the circling workshops and participate with a lot of people that he's had on his YouTube channel. So it started as kind of a cognitive intellectual affiliation, and then has just grown to a much more human embodied level.
And then you made the effort to get all the way up to Thunder Bay for the conference.
Oh, I was so excited about that. Yeah, because For so many reasons. I get to see John. Like, I think we shared, I don't know, 2 or 3 or 4 meals while we were there, and got to wander around Thunder Bay and hang out. And he is not like a potted plant, like he said. He's actually just so interesting. I mean, he's like Doctor Strange or something like that. Much more apt. So I've gotten to know Christopher. That was the first time we met in person. and Savilla King, who I now talk with like once a week, and we're reading a book together. And so I just keep like the bottomlessness of love. I just keep opening up more to this corner, and it gives back, and I open up more, and it gives back, and it really did start a lot, which is my fascination with learning and the mind and things like that, which John is. When he started talking those lectures about religio and artifacts and credo, and I was like, this is so insightful. Like these views he's talking about are synthesizing kind of religion and cognitive science in such a powerful way that because cognitive science, unfortunately, just disavows the deep meaning stuff. I mean, for many, many reasons, it's really hard to go as deep into, like, even in religious departments. They're like a lot of non-religious people in religious studies departments. And so when someone like you and Jonathan and John are able to kind of be so articulate in such a multi-apt way, I'm just like, oh, this is awesome. Why go elsewhere, you know? So I was a little long-winded, but
No,
yeah.
not at all. Well, I'm not going to point fingers at that.
Fair enough.
So where do you want to see this go for you? I mean, what is the telos? What does this take you to?
Yeah, I mean, it's just I keep opening up to it, and like I think I'm working on some wisdom projects with some of the people in John's community, and trying to like you and like he, I have a job that I've set up very purposefully to have a lot of free time. And then I use that free time to participate in this community. My little YouTube channel is fun to do. Like I said, I do these since John's meditation practice. I've done meditative contemplative activities every day since then. You know, participating in that conference. I just want to keep growing that part of my life and finding ways to educate myself and then now give back. I'll be John's new series is coming back. Are coming out in a couple of weeks. He said December 2nd, and I get to participate with the Stoa and lead some discussions about it. And I'm just like, awesome. Like, I don't care if it never makes me a dime. It's some of the most meaningful events for me to do, and just the relationships are out of the world. The amount of just amazing people that I've met is, you know, worth a king's ransom. It's an embarrassment of riches participating in these communities. So I just see myself being kind of open to not making a foolish overcommitment and giving up everything to go into the woods, so to speak, but trying to balance like my family life, my work life, and then this kind of fellowship life. And it's so rewarding. I mean, the people are some of the best people that I've ever met. And I've had some amazing friends. I value friendship kind of always. So just like I was excited to talk to you. I remember just to share with you, I kept going like YouTube algorithm. Why do you keep putting this Christian in my feed? Why is this old Christian showing up? And I would go like, no, scroll down, click on a John video, and you'd pop up again a week later. And then I'd start to listen, and I'd go like, oh no, this guy's really interesting. And then I'd see, you know, John talk to you, and I go, oh, a friend of my friend is a friend, and it just kind of opened. And you know, yeah, just the whole thing is great, and I'm just very open to continue to grow and try to give back and stuff. I'm lucky that now I'm in a position to start to use some of what I learned to share and stuff like that.
So is John collaborating with Peter? You mentioned the Stoa, that's Peter Lindbergh's. Is there going to be a more formal connection between that and the new series coming out?
We're
Or
working it out right now. Yeah, I think
oh, okay.
so. I'll be talking to John Friday about something different, but I'm sure I'll bring it up. And yeah, it's hopefully going to be like this again. This is all still up in the air, but like the Stoa, which has its own community,
Right.
and then like John and his Patreons, and we're going to hopefully have like a launch event, and then it'll be like a
Oh.
weekly thing that we're still nailing the details down, where people can come, because John's new series, I guess, is going to have practices and kind of like questions for discussion built into the episodes. So we're going to try and take that and then just have it be a place where we can apply the psychology, like, and apply the science and participate in it beyond the propositional awesomeness that John's frameworks give. But yeah, that's kind of the.
Okay. Because the Stoa, I mean, it's funny because the Stoa is sort of this corner adjacent. Peter has been, I mean, Peter, knows what I do. I know what he does. I've been on the Stoa once. I was going to be on again. And unfortunately, I'm dyslexic. And sometimes unless I really nail down the time difference, I'll sometimes flip it the other way. And so I was going to be on an episode with John and Jordan Hall, and I've never done anything with Jordan Hall, and it would be
Oh,
kind
cool.
of
Yeah.
interesting to talk to Jordan sometime.
Yeah,
But
definitely.
I messed up the time, I messed up the time difference. But no, Peter's done a lot of interesting stuff with the Stoa. I haven't watched a lot of it. Sam Adams in my little community here mentioned, and I think quite rightly, that we're really missing rebel wisdom. Rebel wisdom filled kind of a network hole
Yeah, they
in.
were amazing. They were such a gateway to this community and a big umbrella for it. I agree, because I was kind of sad for that fact, because John appeals to a certain type of people, Jonathan Peugeot appeals to a certain type of people, but David, I think you were on that project that your name was on that listserv, at least. And yeah, he had a very cool connector role that I agree it will definitely be missed. And yeah, I would love to see more of you on the Stoa too, because it's one of Peter's big insight was like, there's these tribes everywhere, we need to go beyond the tribes and bringing people in. I was secretly really excited that a Christian was coming on my channel, because it's really hard for me. I reach out to people and I go, oh, you have this really cool presence, or there's people that write good research in the religious world. I go, oh, will you come on my YouTube channel? And then I think they see it's a more multicultural or multi-perspectival place and reject it. And John actually told me yesterday, one of the things he loves about you, let me quote him, is that you, he says this, he says, there's really only a couple people who I would say of who love wisely. It's more important than perceptual, conceptual expertise. Not to say that you don't have that. Socrates argued for knowing how to care the right way, the rationality of caring. Paul exemplifies that. Caring, concerning, reaching out for connection, bringing that living care into it. He said he admired it a lot, and that you use all these virtues to build community in this corner of the internet. And also, like, how you are. He said, not in a malevolent way, but like in a good faith way, like you have the courage to kind of go beyond the norms of like the bigger church that you're in and connect people. And it's like, first of all, just like my whole like chest and torso felt John's care when he was saying that. It was really a profound human moment. And it really is a gift you have that even like I try to think about it, like, how does he do that? And it's really cool though, and people need that, because I've mentioned in the email, like, I read a lot of Eckhart. One of my best friends, who I met through John's meditation, is now in a pastor training, and there's so much wisdom in the Christian tradition that homing in it and partnering with it is better than reinventing things, like reinventing fire. And it's I read the New Testament with some friends once a week as well, the David Bentley Hart version, because they love that version. And every week, like all of us are like, oh my gosh, this is the best story. There's so much about love and pain and connection and sacrifice. And yeah, it's the whole thing needs to come back together. It's the gathering of the whole thing. And I know you do have to go pretty soon. But
We should, maybe we'll land the plane in 15 minutes. How's that sound?
yeah, absolutely.
Okay. Now the there's a the church, John has just given so much helpful language to And it takes a while for some of these concepts to sort of sink in so that you can see it. But part of, you know, what you just talked about in the church is a degree of opponent processing where it's clear we all need boundaries, because without boundaries, we can't differentiate. And without that differentiation, we can't actually love, because love crosses boundaries. That's the whole point about love. For me to love another human being, there's a boundary. There's me and then there's them, and love crosses that boundary. So to love, you need boundaries. And for boundaries to be meaningful, they have to be enforced and sometimes policed. And so what that leads is sort of opponent processing between boundaries and love. They need each other, but they have to interact. And so you really have to... there's a Tim Keller article that recently was out about the winsomeness. It's a video I want to make, but we have to, the whole business about loving is learning to bless the other without blessing the other who is different without losing yourself.
Yeah. Psychologically, that's like a therapeutic thing. And okay, I can be totally into your perspective, but then if I'm not paying attention to myself, that's going to lead, especially in the long term, to very unhealthy places. Or I can be a complete tower and push everything away. Same problem. We talked about that a lot in the beginning. But when you can learn, especially like in a group, as it gets bigger, a group of four, a group of eight, or, you know, a group of 400, when you can hold both yourself and the other,
right?
It's like double agape or something. It's beautiful. And I'm super open, so I can, and I love perspective, so I can get into people's perspective very easily. But it's like when I can do it in a way that holds integrity with me and with the other, or give people the integrity to say, I don't know what you mean, but I'm going to actually give you the integrity to be you. And then all of a sudden there's this whole like transtemporal, transpersonal reality that's unfolding. Yeah, the you know, in Platonic terms, like the many and the one, like the difference of the many and the unity is even probably the wrong word, of the one, but that connectedness within the many. It's how do these patterns ever get figured out in the first place? And then how do we stick with them once we've kind of started to understand them?
And the irony is, I didn't know any of this language.
Yeah, well, that's the instead of that cultural cognitive grammar, and philosophers are really good at this, some of them, is saying, like, we can't talk unless words have meaning and we're clear on their meaning. We don't want to just overanalyze words till they become, like, repulsive and unattractive. But we need to be able to say, otherwise it's this relativism where it's this power dynamic happens. But if we can say, no, let's get clear on this, and it matters. It's not like, yeah, it's very tricky, but that idea that a culture is the shared language, and that establishing that shared language isn't just trivial. It allows for a self-transcendence through it once it exists, or a beingness in it once it exists. That, yeah, it's I mean, look at the Christian language that punctuates atheistic speech, right? Like, it's so beautiful. The Christian metaphors and the sacrifice and the you're crucifying me and he's a martyr. And it's like, well, that used to be our common tongue, and we could talk about life through that common tongue. And now in this kind of pluralist, individualist, scientific mechanism also destroys that common language. But yeah, it's super important. I think part of the awesome work you do is translating and clarifying people like Jordan Peterson and John to allow that community to start to talk more with these words.
Well, John has been so helpful in terms of giving me those words, because, I mean, people will look at me and they'll say, well, how do you manage to do this? And I basically say, I don't know. And because a lot of who I am, I've learned from my father. I've learned from churches. I've learned from ministry. We didn't have any of, you know, what Job called fancy verveke words. We didn't have opponent processing. We didn't have combinatorial explosiveness. We didn't have relevance realization. I didn't have any of that language. I had to learn all of that. And then I had to sort of figure out how that language mapped onto what I saw, you know, what I saw in my father. I so wish my father died in 2013. And he was 77, and so he wasn't that old. He just had a sudden heart attack, and that was it. But if my father were alive today, he would be having so much fun with this stuff. He would be enjoying it. I mean, he would be watching these videos. I'd have them on my channel. It would be, you know, it would just be, because so much of this stuff that I didn't even know I do.
Yeah.
I do because I watched him do it, and I didn't even know I was absorbing it.
Right. We learn through imitation. We don't need to know how we do things. It's a paradoxical, often overlooked part of our humanity, is that I don't need to know how I breathe to breathe. I don't need to, if I have a model, I can just imitate that model. And you see other animals do this too, or animals do this too, and they just imprint and they don't question it. We have this conscious mind, this cognitive mind, but yeah, when you start to have the vocabulary, and it's so cool to be able to talk to people in ways that you couldn't before. And yeah, it's we take that for granted because we're so relativistic and we think like words don't matter, and nominalism as well. It's John and Jordan too, right? Jordan Peterson gave people this existential vocabulary, because some of his best lectures are on existentialism, which Socrates, I think, was an existentialist. Christ was an existentialist. These people were not just arguing semantically, getting that vocabulary to connect people. I mean, that's kind of what a culture is. If you censor speech, you're trying to kill a culture.
Well, and I think Jordan, too, did a lot of modeling. And in terms of, it's clear Jordan sort of gathered, and so especially the initial phases of what I did, I sort of worked from Jordan's gathering, because I knew that, you know, in terms of what the level that he was getting to, there was going to be a lot underneath that wasn't, you know, he was just on the status rocket, and there's going to be a lot of work that needed to be doing underneath. But he also modeled the use of YouTube for this. And that was a revelation to me, because I didn't know what YouTube was. I didn't know its capacity. I didn't know anything about it. And then I'm watching him do this, and it's like, there's a tool.
Yeah.
We might, you know, I was playing around with YouTube, but I didn't know anything about it. And so often we don't know anything about anything until we play.
New technologies, especially, right? Like, you follow the leader and you can find someone that go, oh, wow, that can do that. And then, like John Vervaeke says, like, reverse engineer that. And I always try to take things from like the third person and start to see them in my first person. And when I start to see and feel things, I go, oh, there's that idea. Like, knowing you're going to die and knowing you're going to die are two different things. And so, yeah, people like John and Jordan, and you and Jonathan Peugeot, do that. They help us bridge the unconscious and the articulate and the embodied. It's a beautiful thing.
Well, I think we should. Any final thoughts you want to get out before we end transmission here?
No. But would you be open to doing this again sometime?
Sure. That'd awesome. Be fun. And maybe bring in, if you've got another friend. I often find that, I mean, one-on-one is good, but sometimes another, you have a, you know, three, then you get more ideas to sort of bounce off each other. So,
I'll definitely do that and reach out sometime.
So that would be fun.
Cool. Well, thank you so much, Paul. It was great to meet you in person for a moment. And I just appreciate all of what you're doing.
Well, thanks for reaching out, Robert. And I'll post this on my channel probably in a few days. And because again, part of what, I mean, for me, the goal of this is the knitting together of the relationships, of the fabric of the community. So that's really key. So
yeah, it's powerful stuff for sure. And it's a cool community to be a part of.
All right. Okay. All right. Good talking to you, Robert. Take care.
Yeah. Thanks so much. You too.
Bye-bye.
Bye.